Okay. So, we are... No coffee. I'm working on that still. Yeah, we're in Hilchos Deos. We're up to Perakei Halacha Yud Bet, 512. I figured if we're spending five prakim studying about moderation and how we have to find balance, and I'm drinking like 10 cups of coffee a day, kind of rings a little hollow, you know? So, had to do... Something good had to come out of my learning Hilchos Deos. So, all right. This is really a continuation of the discussion sort of that we've been having. You don't necessarily have to say that that's what the Rambam intended, but it's definitely a sort of a point that obviously comes up. So what does the Rambam say here? V'asur lo la'adam lehafkir o lagdish kol nechasav v'yatriach al abriyot. You can't, like let's say some guy gets the bug. He wants to just do mitzvahs. So he says, I'm going to give all my money to tzedakah. I want to live the poverty-stricken life. Sounds very idealistic and very noble, right? The Rambam was vehemently against this. I believe that the Torah is against this. I think that the Chazal are against this, and the Gemara makes this very clear in a number of places. But right now we're studying Rambam. What's wrong with that, just out of curiosity? What do you think is wrong with that?
According to Halakha.
Why?
So that, like,
you go to an orphanage. They're desperate. They have no food. They need help. Not pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh is a different story. If you're in Nazi Germany and you give up all your money to save one more person from going to Auschwitz, that's obviously not only halachic, that's obligated. That's a separate issue, right? But I'm talking about you go to an orphanage, you feel for these kids. Say like me, I'm gonna go back to my nice apartment and have my nice house. I'm just gonna give it all up. I'll sell my car, sell my house, sell everything. Not married yet. I'll start from scratch. Halacha says, the Rambam says, you should not do that. Why? Why? Yeah?
You'll become dependent on society.
That's why. And I'll show you that's why. Now, by the way, what that means is, if you're giving up all your property, but you know you're not going to be dependent on society, you know, like you got a job, and, you know, they tell you that they're giving you a $1 million deposit on your job, then you're not really giving up all your nechassim. Or if you give up your money and you're going into the army, and you know that for the next 3 years you don't have to worry about living off society. I suppose you can make a case for these things, but you'll see that even that is inappropriate.
What about
right?
The 1880s or the 1890s when the Jews, a lot of Jews started making aliyah to Israel and gave up all their possessions in Europe to come here and really start with nothing and live off of a lot of your benefactors?
Doesn't it say that
first of all,
coming to Israel overrides like everything else?
Right. In other words, coming to Israel is a separate issue because you're doing it for the sake of a mitzvah. And Eretz Yisrael no niknet al yadei yisurin. In other words, it's true that you have to go through a certain amount of travail. It's a very good question. In other words, if you're going to give up all your money, right? I'll give you a better example. If you study, right? Your question, Shlomo, is, well, what if a person, in order to make aliyah, has to give up all his earthly possessions and start from scratch? By the way, that was very rarely the case. Very rarely the case that a person was coming and would have to be dependent and on the dole. He came, he went to a kibbutz, he went to wherever, and he found a way to make it work. There was a Jewish agency, there was a joint, but these people were not coming. But let's say, like in the 1950s, when the Jews came from Morocco and Yemen, then there was a pikuach nefesh issue. In other words, they had to get out because it was dangerous, right? But I'll give you an interesting example. Because sometimes you can make that call and you could be wrong. The best example I can think of is Nazi Germany in 1933, right? If you look at what was going on until 1938, really until Kristallnacht almost, which was November of 1938, November 10th, I think, Jews could get out. And the Nazis wanted them to get out because that supported their mission, which was to have a completely Judenrein Germany and Austria to be Jew-free, right? Now, there were certain catches. For example, they imposed a flight tax, which was that they would assess. By this time, Jews had to report, in fact, all Germans had to report all of their assets. So even if you managed to hide things, they had a number for you, like your house, your car, your worth, your money in the bank, everything you own. You had to give 25%, right, in order to leave the country. And in fact, they estimate that... that in today's market, today being 2007, and I just saw an article on this, they estimate that the Nazis got $6.5 billion in today's money from this exercise. It's an enormous amount of money. Back then, I think it was something like $6 million, something like that, $6.5 million. But So the Jew sitting in Germany says, okay, it's 1934. This is going to blow over. Like, the Germans aren't going to tolerate this. They really, a lot of people really believed that, this wouldn't last. And it made sense. They had the Weimar Republic. It died. Like, you know, governments were very fluctuating in those times after World War I. So they thought, but one of the principal reasons that people struggle with this was because, what do I do? So I give up that significant amount of money. It basically means that I'm going to be poverty-stricken. I'm going to go to some country. By the time I'm finished paying the tickets, I mean, the St. Louis, which is the famous story of the boat, which was the last boat to leave Germany in 1938, and it went around the world, and basically nobody would take these Jews in, and except for some of the children, they were forced back to Germany, and most of them died in the Holocaust, in Auschwitz especially, right, Treblinka. And in order to get on that boat, and by that time everybody wanted to get out, you had to pay $500. $500 I read an article on this one too. In 1990, $500 of 1938 was equivalent to approximately $10,000. Okay? Now you do the math. You're a Jew in 1938. You can't work in your profession, right? You can't study in university. Your shop is now pretty much destroyed, and you have no income because there's a boycott, right? You have no money. And you've got to come up with $10,000 for each of your family members. Let's say you've got four kids. That's $60,000. You're done. Even if you can figure it out and you get relatives to send you money from the States, you're done. So there were families who said, how can we do that? How in 1934 can we go and give up everything? And here's the basis for it. So obviously, if you think it's pikuach nefesh, right? But that's a legitimate question. Are there circumstances? When do circumstances override this? But I'm talking about the general situation. I'm talking about a guy who sits in Teaneck and he says, you know what? I don't need money. I'm going to go learn in yeshiva. And I won't have a job and I won't have a profession, but the community will support me and there'll be Torah in the world. So the Rambam seems to say that that's a problem. Can't give up all your property via triach al briyot and make it difficult for others because they have to support you. And then he goes on in terms of how this works. You should never sell a field. Now this is not a halacha. There's no iser. This is just the Rambam saying, you want to study moderation, moderation is everything. And just like you have to learn moderation in eating, and you have to learn moderation in character development, you have to learn moderation when you manage your finances. Why is it better to have a field than a house?
Field produces money.
Because, right, a field is tangible income, and it can never be destroyed. Even if the field gets burned, right, so you lose a year, but you can plant again next year. Right now, that's in their world. There are, I'm sure, equivalents in modern-day society, right? But basically, the field, land... Did you ever read a book by Pearl Buck called The Good Earth? Anybody ever read that book? Yeah, right? So she basically posits that the most... This is in China. The most important thing is land. Land is something you can depend on. Even with real estate up and down. If you own land, you own something. A house on the other hand. A house can be destroyed. An earthquake can come. A flood can come. It can be ruined, you know. It can be burned, whatever it might be, right? Okay. If you have a house, okay, says the Rambam, for low bite, you can name a talton. Don't sell your house to buy perishables, to buy goods. Now, the guy has a brilliant idea, and he sees that the metal market is going up. So he says, I'm going to sell my house, and I'm going to buy steel. Because I see the winds of war coming, and I think that whoever has steel is going to make a fortune, because steel is going to go up, because they're going to need it to build armory, right? You don't sell your house to buy steel. You have to have a minimum stability in your life of economics, right? Okay? Oh, yeah, says chorah bidmei beto, or make business on your house. Now, this is an interesting discussion. What does that really mean?
Is that like a mortgage or a mortgage?
That's right. Like a double mortgage. Like, the Rambam says, don't do that. Don't take that risk. It's not worth it.
Not talking about renting?
Pardon?
Renting out your house?
Pardon?
He's not talking about renting out your house?
Well, schorah bidmei beto means to make business on the money of your house. In other words, if you have a house and you're renting it out, and that money you can depend on, if you take that money and you take a business venture on it, you're risking your house, right? You could make a case of saying that this occurred, that this is by, you know, sort of subprime mortgages and double mortgages and whatever they might be. And you look at what's going on today, the people who took these risks, you know, like you have a person who gets a house, takes out a mortgage. That's a different story. That's a person who's trying to get a property, right? But now he's got this house, and he says, okay, you know what? I'll put up my house as a collateral in order to get a loan, in order to finance a business. Now, if the business goes haywire, you lose your house. So the Rambam says, that's not a good thing to do. Shouldn't do that. Be careful with that. You have to have a certain amount of stability. You know what I mean? Yeah. Right. And this is like 1,000 years ago, right? 800 years ago. Not only that, but when you manage your money, and look, some people spend, I mean, I know a fellow, He's a Rav in Yeshiva, and he must spend 2 hours a day playing the market, trading, doing all these things, because he feels an achrayos to try to figure out a parnasa for his family. I personally don't do that. I don't really know how the market works. I'm not a trader. I'm not into that stuff. You have to have a certain amount of time in your life that you look at your budget, you make sure that the amount that's coming in, right, is a little more than what's going out. Otherwise, something's wrong. And you meet people who don't do this, and they don't know how to make ends meet at the end of the month. And by the way, this is before bitachon. Obviously, I want you to understand at the end of the day, and that's why I don't spend an enormous amount of time on this, because at the end of the day, you can do your planning, and you can do your budgeting. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides you're going to have no money, you're going to have no money. And if HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides you're going to have a lot of money, you'll have a lot of money. But you, within the realm of your responsibility, of your ishtadlus, you have to at least be reasonable. You know, a family says, we want to go on a vacation. Okay, it's a legitimate thing. You want to go away, spend some quality family time, and you found a way to do it, it's going to cost you $2,000. But if you know that in the whole year, you have $90 more, you know, sort of left over at the end of every month, you don't spend $2,000 to go with your family. Because then you go into debt. Not a healthy thing to do. You find a healthy way to live. On the other hand, if you know that at the end of the year you're saving $50,000, then it's reasonable. So how do you do that? You have to know what's coming in and what's going out. You have to have a reasonable assessment. There has to be a certain amount of money that doesn't get traded on the stock market. That sits in a dependable, I don't know, some people say, I had a friend who was a big Rosh Yeshiva who was a big believer in buying bonds. Because he said that if you buy bonds for certain countries, that's reasonably safe. And you know that in the world of trading and stocks and whatever, so they grade investments. They're high risk, medium risk, low risk. The lowest risk, the most conservative investments, usually bonds. And they'll give you back your dependable 5 to 7 to 10% depending on when you got them. And you'll have them for 7 years. And you'll know you have a certain amount of money. You won't make what you could make on a big stock market, you know, 30% a year, you know, scheme. But you'll know that, you know, when you have to marry off your daughter, you'll have some money. You won't be going around collecting staka, right? Within reason, right? So that's what the Rambam is saying here. You have to find balance in all these things, right? You meet somebody who's 49 years old, who didn't actually lose. I'm not talking about whether the market goes bust or you lose your job. These things happen to a lot of people. I'm talking about a guy has a job, his wife has a job, and somehow at the end of the month, they're just destitute. They don't know what to do. And the debtors are calling and the hackers, something's wrong. Figure out how to get out of debt, right? You see these advertisements, get out of credit cards. Credit cards, by the way, are a terrible thing. I'll give you a piece of advice that's straight out of halacha. When you go to college, you will start to get all these offers for credit cards, okay? It happens in Israel when students go to the army, right? Because they know that they want you as a credit card owner for their credit company, and so they give you all these deals, you know, free for a year, no interest on purchases for the first 2 years. They do all this stuff. Why? Because you get comfortable with this credit card company, right? And then when you sort of have a little earning power, you start to spend money, and you don't realize how it works. But when you buy things on a credit card and it gets put off, eventually it catches up with you, you could be paying 18% on these items. And if you're buying big items, before you know it, you've finished your college experience, and now you've got like $50,000 in debt in addition, and you have no credit rating. And then when you need to get a proper credit card and put down on a house and all these things, you can't buy a house because you have a terrible credit rating. So this is straight out of the Rambam. You know what I mean? Buying things on credit is a dangerous thing to do. You have to know how, when, why, whatever it might be, right? Okay? Aval mocher hu metaltelin v'kona sadeh. But if you can sell goods in order to buy land, that's a good thing to do. Now again, I don't want everybody here to assume that I'm saying you should always buy land. Like you could have land, you know, that's dead weight in Nebraska. I don't know, you know, I'm just saying as a principle, right? Klalo shel davar, yasim megamato latzliach nechasav ulachlif hakaleh bakayam. What's the basic rule? It's good to manage your financial affairs so that you're transforming goods that are temporary into things that are stable, that are constant, that are more viable. Does that make sense? Okay? Like there are some people who invest in cars. They say Jay Leno has like 35 different cars. I don't know what a person would need with cars, but it's like people who buy these bottles of wine that are worth a fortune, that age with time, and they buy a wine cellar, and it's an investment. People invest in different things, right? But if you invest in wine, you can buy bottles of wine that are tens of thousands of dollars. Go figure. I once on a plane saw an article about a bottle of wine that was auctioned at Sotheby's for something like $140,000 because it was a bottle of wine that was still around and preserved and good wine from the French Revolution.
Give it to Marvel.
Right? Now, let's say you had $150,000 and you wanted to invest in something. So it would be reasonable to say, right, that that if you bought that bottle of wine and you waited 50 years, your investment would go up. What's the problem with that? Problem with that is, if anything ever happens to that bottom line, you just lost your $150,000. Now, if you're a billionaire, and that's a small percentage, I guess it's not a big deal, right? But if you're guys like us, where $150,000, that's what you have in the world. That's everything, right? So you don't take everything you have and put it into a bottle of wine. That's crazy. Take that money, put a down payment on a house, on land, whatever it might be, so that you can start your life and be stable. That's what the Rambam is saying here. And that's moderation, right?
That would mean, like, never play the stock market, ever.
Well, again, it depends on percentages. In other words, there are major organizations that closed down because all the money that they had was dependent on the stock market and were dependent on an individual donor and money in the bank, which is also metallic, and money is perishable. It's not like land, right? There was a foundation called the Chase Foundation, and post-Madoff, this fellow Chase basically lost everything. This foundation was totally dependent on this one donor. I had a fellow who I'm still friendly with, a very special person, who once gave me a good advice. He's one of the first major donors that ever donated like this kind of money to Israelite, I don't know, $25,000, $50,000, or at least through me. And he gave me a brilliant piece of advice, right? He wanted to know what the budget at the time of Israelite was, and he said, look, I just want you to know. He said, I'm not going to float your organization. He said, and it's not because I couldn't do it. I could do it. I could give you $1 million for a year, for 5 years, and you wouldn't have to worry about fundraising. He said, the reason I wouldn't do it is because ultimately, that's a bad thing for you to do. Said he learned from Reichman, who was a major, major donor in the Jewish world, a philanthropist. And Reichman would always tell him, you should never be more than 10% of any project. Because that way, if you go under, that project won't go under with you, right? So I thought that was a really good piece of advice. And over the years, we worked very hard, to make sure that we didn't get one major donor who supplied all the funding, but rather that we have different people who supplied percentages. And Bemet, and we've had this now happen twice. It happened once when the World Trade Center went down. Happened a second time a couple years ago, where some of the major donors just disappear off the map. They lose all their money. They can't help you. They had a whole project that was funded by a donor, but the yeshiva and the Beis Medrash and the program didn't fold. Well, it didn't fold because Hashem decided it shouldn't fall. But the vehicle by which Hashem decided it shouldn't fall was that there wasn't one person that we were totally dependent on. And Bemet, this fellow Reichman, who gave him this advice, folded. He went bankrupt overnight. I mean, his bankrupt and our bankrupt are two different things. He still owned his land, so he wasn't poverty-stricken. But basically, the yeshivot that were dependent on him went through a very difficult time. But none of them closed down. Because he was only 10% of any one yeshiva. So you can cut corners and make tight if you have to cover 10%. You can't do that if you have to cover 50%. That's the same principle. You have to find balance. You have to find moderation in everything you do. That's what the Rambam is doing here. He's creating a recipe where your whole life is balanced. Right? V'lo tiyeh kavanato le'anot me'at lefi sha'ah. What's the reason that people get into this sort of trouble? They get into this sort of trouble because they're looking at the now instead of the down the road. Like, you should always begin with the end in mind. You know? Like, you get to college next year, okay? And they give you a grant. You have, like, a living expense grant, whatever. And they say to you, okay, you know, you're going to get... And most colleges don't do this. They give you a scholarship. They don't give you the whole sum up front. They give it to you monthly, precisely because they don't want you to blow it all on a week of beer, right? So let's say you get, though, you get your $10,000, and that's supposed to be living expenses, you know, for a year. And you figure, you know what, I'm going to get a job. I can earn $1,000 a month. What's the big deal? I'll get a job. So I'm going to take this $10,000, I'm going to get myself a car. Because it'll be so much easier for me if I have a car. So the Rambam would say that's a big mistake. Because you're taking all that money and you're putting it into something perishable, and tomorrow that car could be totaled. And you could be out of luck and out of money. Right? Et cetera, et cetera. So you have to find your balance. Why would a person do that? Because he's thinking more about the now than down the road. Make sense? Okay? Or he's willing to enjoy a little bit so that he can and lose a lot. And let me show you, just in terms of the first part of this, because there's two things that come out of this Rambam. One is that the Rambam clearly has an issue with people who are willing to give everything away and take the risk of living on the dole. So the Rambam, at the end of Sefer Aflah, in Hilchos Erechin, okay, Erechin and Charamin is basically a person can make a neder. Back when there was a Beis HaMikdash, right? A person could make a neder, okay? And vow that that he wants this animal to go to the Beis HaMikdash. or I'm going to take my carpentry shop, and it's worth, it's erech, erechin, is going to go to the Beis HaMikdash, right? And a person would, you know, be inspired to donate to the Beis HaMikdash, or to Levim, or to Kohanim, or to Tzedakah, right? So this is all the halachas of how that works. If you say something like that, when are you obligated? What are you obligated to? How does it work? How do you switch carbon if this carbon you said that this is going to go to the Beis HaMikdash, and now it has a mum, it has a blemish, right? So at the end of all these halachos, okay, which is the end of Sefer HaFlah, which means that this is a very important halacha, the Ram says like this, Leolam, Leolam lo yakdish adam v'lo yachrim kol nechasav. A person should never dedicate or be machrim, in other words, set aside all of his property, right? Even to the Beit HaMikdash. Ve'ha'osek hein, and somebody who does that, over al dat ha'katuv. Now that doesn't mean he's transgressing a particular prohibition. It means he's going against the spirit of what the Torah wants of you. She'areyu omer mikol asher lo. A person is supposed to give to the Beit HaMikdash from all that he has. V'lo yachrim, right, mikol asher lo, v'lo kol asher lo. It doesn't say kol asher lo, everything he has. It says mikol asher lo, from all that he has. But he should be left with a lot of what he has. Right? K'mo she'be'aru chachamim, ve'ein zu chasidut. Don't think you're such a big chasid, you're giving 50% of what you own to tzedakah. Don't think you're such a big chasid, you decided you can take your whole life savings and everything you own, and you're going to give it to the hospital for orphans. You know what this is? He says, "Lo'ein zo chasidut el shtut." This is foolishness. It's folly. It doesn't do the Jewish world or the world or society any good if they get one more person who's on the dole. She'areyu me'abed kol mamanovi, yitzterech lebriyot. He's going to need other people's help. Ve'ein merachmin alav. That's a very severe line. Don't have any pity on such a fellow. He's an idiot. He has no business doing that. He hasn't studied Torah. Ubaze, uchayotze, boamru chachamim, chasid shote michlal mivle olam. Ela kol ha-mefazer mamono b'mitzvot, al yefazer yoter michomesh. If you give out money for mitzvot, you're not supposed to give out more than a fifth. In other words, the range of what you're obligated or what you're allowed to give is 20%. This is one of the sources of that halacha. Right? So you have a chiyuv to make sure that you don't give away everything you have for money. And then the Rambam goes a stage further. Okay? If you look in Hilchot Matnot Aniyim, by the way, it's very interesting, the set of halachot that are called Matnot Aniyim, gifts to the poor. So where does the Rambam put that? Like you would think that should be in Sefer Ahava, the book of love, like Tefillah, and, right? He puts it in the book that's called Zra'im. Zra'im are all the halachot that relate to agriculture. Right? You have in Sefer Zra'im, now this is Bet, you have in Sefer Zra'im, you have Kilayim, you know, like sort of mixed breeds, what you're allowed to plant together and whatnot. You have Trumot, Maser, Maser Sheni, Bikurim, Shemitah, and Yovel. In the middle of this, Matnot Anim, because the whole agricultural system was based on the idea that a percentage of what you own, you give to tzedakah. So we'll finish with this. The Rambam says, right, at the end of Matnot Anim, what does he say? Listen to this. Le'olam yidchok adam atzmo, ve'yitgalgel b'tzar. A person should roll in pain, should struggle, should be willing to suffer rather than become dependent on society. You shouldn't want to be, you shouldn't create a system for yourself that allows you to be on the dole. And that's one of the problems sort of that the religious community is struggling with, because you have so many people who are sitting and learning Torah and they're totally dependent on society. They're living on welfare, they have no jobs, and if you ask my opinion, as much as I understand the need for people learning Torah, I think the potential, the creation of such a huge Chilul Hashem is a big challenge. And the Rambam clearly seems to be against this. By the way, it doesn't mean a person couldn't sit in yeshiva all day and create a business on the internet and support his family at night. Like, I'm not against that. I think that'd be tremendous. Right? If I could find a way to work and I didn't want to run a yeshiva, I just want to learn Torah, and I could learn all day. And I know people who are dentists in the afternoon, they learn all morning. I know somebody who has a business that runs off the internet, and every 3 weeks he has to go to America for a couple days, and the rest of the time he sits and learns, and at night he does business. It's tremendous. But that's not what we're talking about here, right? V'chein tzivu chachamim v'amru, asei shabbatcha chol, v'al tzarech lebriot. Make your Shabbos a weekday and don't need people's help. In other words, take a job as a parnas in the shul if you have to, right? V'afilu haya chacham u'mechubad, v'ha'ani better, even if he's a Talmud Chacham and he has to deal with the most mundane work, to become a janitor, better to be a Rosh Hashiva working as a janitor than to need people's tzedakah. Right? Mutav lifshot or beimot nevelot v'lo yomar la'am chacham gadol ani kohen ani parnasuni. Better that a person has to work in a tannery. The tannery in the Gemara was the epitome of the place that was disgusting. It was a horrible smell. It was blood and meat and skinning animals. It's horrible work. Right, stinks. Filth. Better to work in a tannery than to say, I'm a talmud chacham and I need a respectable work. Pardon? That's a definite question. That's how your makdis your yetzer. But I'm talking about in terms of earning a parnasa. Ubechach tzivu chachamim. Gdolei achachamim, ayu mehem chotvei etzim. And the greatest talmidei chachamim were woodchoppers, some of them, v'nosei akarot, and carriers of beams, and water carriers, shoavei mayim, right, etc., etc. V'lo shalu min hatzibur, v'lo kidlu mehem kishenatnu lehem. And they didn't ask of the tzibur, of the community, and they didn't accept it when it was offered them. They didn't want to be dependent on society. And that's what the Rambam is saying here. You have to find balance. It can't be that you, as a goal, are allowing yourself to become dependent on society. And that raises all sorts of questions. Like, let's say you're in university, you take student loans, you're basically dependent on society. So a person says, well, right now I'm going to work. Like, I don't think that this year, it's reasonable for a guy to say, I'm coming to this over here, learning to already grow myself, so maybe I should get a job so that my parents don't have to support me. Right? That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a person who does this for a lifetime. You know, if you go to university, you say, okay, for 4 years, I'm not really going to be able to support myself, but when I finish, I'll have a respectable job, and I'll pay back my loans, and I'll be able to help my parents when I'm older. So then that makes sense to me. And that's the navigating a person has to do with this. Yes?
What the new healthcare plan that came out of America is, even though it's a privatized healthcare, basically reliant a lot on public funds and taxpayer funds. Could you be able to make a case from this that you should maybe not be using through that healthcare and use
So I'll answer this question, and then we have to stop because you guys got to walk. But just to finish this off, there's a difference between the obligation of the tzibur, the community, towards the individual who needs to be in the dole, and the obligation of the individual not to be in the dole. In other words, Israel has a welfare system and has socialist medicine, and I think that's great. And I think we have a responsibility. Like, the one piece of the there are a lot of problems with America's health care plan. We're definitely not going to get into that.
Yeah.
And that would be an understatement. But one of the valuable things of that plan is that at least its goal is that there shouldn't be 30 million Americans who have no access to health care. And if we have to support them, then so be it. That doesn't make them right, though. They should want to try to find... You have some people who just, they're out of a job. They have no way to do it. Then there's some people that are interested in having a job. If you go to a guy who's a computer programmer, you know what? I have such tremendous respect for many of the Russian Olim who came here. I've met people who look, we had a fellow who cleaned here at the beginning of the year, and then he had back problems, remember? Right? He was a brilliant guy. A brilliant guy. And he had a degrees in geology and whatever. Right, exactly. Right? So here's a person, right, who has a scholar. I've met people who are PhDs who came from Russia, right? And they're willing to work as janitors rather than be supported on the dole. That's what we're talking about, right? Shouldn't be our goal, but that's a right? But in terms of supporting the people who don't do that or can't do that, that's a different story, right? There is a question of whether society does itself a benefit if it gives people the ability to be on welfare and doesn't force them to do labor, and that's a difficult question. You know, there was a time when people were obligated. In Israel, for example, there were times where, and even today, if you are on welfare and you collect unemployment, you have to be willing to take certain types of jobs, and some people find loopholes and some people don't. Anyway, food for thought. Have an awesome experience.